then I can, if it's any good audio at least, then we can, instead of, I don't have to copy it real time on the thing and try to encrypt it loudly. So yeah, so hopefully we'll see what the quality of what comes out of my phone is. So that's useful. Chris is quite keen that we don't duplicate F between Oxford. So he needs to understand what we're doing. So that's fine. And I do mean to try and get time to encrypt the other one that's on that phone thing thing already from last week. So. So, I don't know if there's anything more to discuss about parallelization. Last week.
That group helps in being like a few things that might be useful to us, like in a way having a directory where your data is the distribution directory. Dynamic data redistribution was definitely useful tools with it, but didn't really come across as being all-encompassing library that would do everything you want to. The library tends to do things in a, well, let's do some work for a while, let's communicate next, then wait for communication to finish, let's do some work for a while. When thinking in parallel, the most obvious thing seems to be to communicate while doing work. But MPI is too low level to handle that. So I haven't been able to find a library that's got trees on top of that. Some of the API to sort of remote memory access functions may do what they want.
How does global array, do they have that remote memory access?
Yeah, I started looking at the aggregate remote memory copy interface, which global array uses, and it looks like it's sort of implementing remote memory access possibly before the API to standard. Looks closer to a start-end operation, and then a wait function. I haven't worked out if you can do a little wait to check, but at least you can start the thing, do some work, and then
go and check. Yeah. But if you don't know how long this edge is going to take, so it gives you a bit more.
Yeah, it may have more than that. Slightly higher level of things that we do with remote team information as well.
Before we go to this document, do you have anything to comment about parallelization? You've been skiing, right?
No, I ski one day.
Oh, yeah.
The issue with doing work while you're sending, I think a lot of people haven't done that because it's difficult enough to write a package to just do standard MPI and then try to optimize it to be while you're sending, so because you can get a different message just on, you know, standard of send and then do work.
And so it might be cheaper to add nodes than to try and re-engineer it.
I went to...
Seems unfortunate, though.
The conference I was at was the Iterative Solvers Conference. And I saw Kirk Jordan give a talk on convolution. What he said in our group was one of the three groups. That was, two groups he had named, one was Texas at Austin, and I forget the other, but maybe we're doing kind of 14 folding. But he was focusing most on the UT Austin group. They're doing, of course, media, oil well problems. And he mentioned that their group was, they were able to port their code to work on BlueJean in 2 days. That's porting pre-existing NK code.
Yeah.
And then he mentioned our group as rewriting our package to be on BlueJean. I didn't say anything to Kirk afterwards. He wouldn't have to say anything. But I guess I learned some interesting things. It does seem like it's a good... IBM's really trying to push this whole new science on BlueJean. That's what Kirk Jordan kept saying. We want to do new science. It's a great thing.
That's the same motto of integrated biology stuff. Be something you couldn't do before.
Right.
Even if you don't really need to do it.
They showed some pretty good results from the UT group. They're doing a lot of essentially elliptic type problems. You know, not embarrassingly parallel coding, but elliptic solvers where you actually have to do a matrix vector and accumulate and go through something. And, I think 512 megabytes is the memory on one of the processors. I didn't even realize that there's one processor totally dedicated to the communication, which I guess helps out a significant amount. But I guess the UT Austin group, one of their big advantages, they already had a parallel code graphic, so they're able to do everything versus just running a. And I don't really know anything about parallel graphics. Packages out there. But I think that was one of the key things was to be able to do everything on BlueJean.
Is BlueJean L the same thing as the different
BlueJeans? I think L was the first, is light, the first, L is light means the first without so many nodes.
Okay, yeah. But based on his talk and other things, I don't think it's necessary to try and focus the MPI code working on BlueJean or something else. I think a lot of people are just writing, I mean, they already have pre-existing MPI code and it's just being ported to BlueJean.
Yeah.
I was kind of under the impression that a lot of the MPI stuff is rewritten or improved for performance on BlueJean.
Okay.
Or if you're using MPI, then they're going to provide you an MPI package that perhaps have improved capabilities for that architecture.
So yeah.
Maybe not focusing on a particular architecture, but just trying to write a good MPI code itself is, I mean, it just takes one thing out of one issue.
But it's one advantage of using MPI as your basis. You might see that architecture as a library.
Yeah, it's a standard package. So in this case, I think IBM gains a lot by having an improved version because their code, their machine looks better. Kirk Jordan, Peter knows him. I think he's the VP of deep computing. But he's always had a strong connection with the multi-group community, mostly because they have a conference in Copper Mountain, big skier.
Yeah. And he was given sort of administrative solver conference.
Yeah, and while CMGUI, you know, is a long way from doing maybe distributed visualization directly, I mean, you could certainly do distributed isosurface evaluation or something. If your structures are distributed, you know, you could tell it to work over the same loops, it wouldn't be hard to do that. Which I think is key as to why I was arguing that we didn't want, you know, that we want the same level of access to these functions in GUI and
been using PET-C in the conference. That's a big one. And because the Department of Energy is represented there, and also people using the Trillion's package in India.
The ones. One that you were talking about.
Yeah. I'd be interested to know how Trillion's handles its graph. I don't really know that at this moment. But I know they're... All their other interface is very nice. They do the mesh, and they can read the different types of meshes. They can create meshes. They have very nice package solvers. And they can do really neat and functionality of graphics. So if that was to be ported to UG, what they would do with the graphics would be interesting. Talked to a few people who use Venus. And I guess the other thing I'm starting to realize more and more is most people use just MPI as their data distribution without using some higher level package.
Yeah.
And based on what I've seen, there doesn't seem to be a lot out there that's higher level. And so just going with the MPI.
I got the spam from Integrated Biology the other day, and congratulating themselves and getting some awards and things. I need to look up and see what I'm supposed to have done.
So what was this meeting that you're at, where was that?
Colorado.
Now, that's all helpful. I think Susanna and I have been iterating over a job description for the programmer. You know how we had our job description? Now we have to turn that into several pages of stuff for them down the road to get a university job description. So we have that description we had, and then the short summary and the summary, and it will know the more detailed summary and the summary, or something. Plus, on the next side, you have pages of requirements, like they must be a nice person, and they have to go to meetings sometimes as required, and all this sort of stuff, so you spell it all out. So we've been doing all that side of things. And then it has to get graded as a job to see how much we're allowed to pay the person. So the university takes away and looks at your job description and decides how much that's worth.
So are they the ones to set the salary then?
Well, the salary is made by a grading system.
How do they know? And that seems really intense.
You get to talk to them about it, okay. I guess. But, yeah. Sure, if they make the decision about what a person who does that sort of thing is worth, it's what...
Because it's quite specific to it.
Yeah, but we have to convey the complexity of it by saying something, I guess. They're very concerned that people who... department assistants or something across the university get in the same scale bracket.
Sure.
Big differences. But yeah, sure, it's on a technical side, it's very hard. And the other thing, of course, is the levels run out. You know, level 6 is it.
Yeah.
A certain level, that's so that it falls within the university system and can't be paid more than other people, which is why the university does some interesting things.
This is more of a
The very few people, we're trying to avoid paying people outside the system.
I guess this goes back to the whole problem of being a research institute, trying to fit into the university framework.
Sure, but we still have lots of academic staff. They seem to totally dodge the system. And know lots of interesting arrangements. It might be taken
into PBRS with companies.
Yeah.
What was that?
Yeah, it's not going to stay. Okay. So, there's lots of progress there, I think. Well, lots of paperwork shuffling around, I guess that's progress.
So it's sitting with the level?
I think it's about with the level up, yeah. By now. The last time I saw that, saw an iteration was Thursday, and I think Susanna and Maria were happy, so yeah. Maria then goes and interacts with the level up. She thought it shouldn't be take too long, but we didn't decide on a date for closing it because we decided it would be kind of a month after the leveler came back. So we could try the end of the month if it came back today or tomorrow, and if it comes back another week or two.
Come on, tell me. What's involved in
it's, do you know that it goes on someone's pile and it's not their most important thing?
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with the quantity of work involved. It's to do with the priority of the person.
So the other thing is Carrie's replacement.
Yeah. So Peter asked Carrie to write a replacement for himself, job description. That came back via Peter. Paul and I. This morning. Or the night or something from Peter, and it's very short at the moment, quite technical, and it's a bit of fleshing out at two levels. One, the kind of an introduction, so it doesn't start saying
context, yeah.
Yeah, and then all the actual tasks which have to go on this other big longer document. Do something about that. So that kind of addresses this, well, you know, physio and developer. The interesting thing is Kerry was quite aghast at our discussion from last week, I think was the appropriate adjective, mostly in the thought that we might go backwards on anything. I was trying to point out that, okay, yeah, sure, he might be able to fix it up, but someone else has to try and understand. I mean, you did point out that, as far as he was concerned, the basic problem was that we'd upgraded the servers underneath, so there was nothing to go back to, because you weren't changing the computers back underneath. And the big change had been that there was no longer a send mail on that computer. It had postfixes, and postfixes had different requirements. No, exactly. But anyway, that was... Sure. I'm just saying what I know. I looked over a shoulder at the piping code that's inside Plone, and to me it's incorrectly written, actually, which is actually the problem as far as I'm concerned. It requires it to send it to the two, but there's no reason to don't have to send mail to the two people, and that's the basic change. We're trying to send it to the two. So he has the wiki mail working, but we haven't resolved why the first error message from a bug tracker doesn't come, or how the other subscription system isn't turned on, I don't think, at the moment, and so on. Still lots there. But I made him just sketch out to me how he was debugging this, and I saw. because he hasn't got send mail on his development or anything, he can't run the debugger, so he just kind of turns live updates on and starts editing the code on the server and it's running. Plone has this mode where you can, it'll recheck all the stamps every time it tries to run a file or whatever, and it'll reload them if you change. So you can kind of edit things and keep playing with it without restarting the server. That's what he's putting print here. Okay, so anyway, so there's progress on those two job fronts, which is good. That'll push some progress along, hopefully. Gives us a time frame to try and figure out what we're going to tell them to do, particularly the API.
So that
PR
job description on, is that like one on the
And it's with the leveler. Then it will come back and then you can get advertised.
This is the faculty
person. I think it's faculty. I can't tell.
What's it?
MPI, what is engineering? Well, we either employ people under engineering or physiology. We prefer to do it under.
Oh, so they're no longer employed under.
No, we're not. The policy is to try and avoid any services unless it's an external contract.
Oh, okay.
And this clearly is. All the research grant ones and stuff that we're trying to change, we've changed all of the IT staff and people such as myself. It's been quite a process.
Yeah, especially. The
no, but I mean, someone like, you know, all our existing IT staff, we had to get their jobs leveled and try and get them.
I'm glad I avoided that.
Good. So then I think the next thing on our agenda is to look at this field and all stuff again. Thank you, Paul, for producing some documents for us to see. Can we post these versions or something that Chris can see them?
I've forgotten my password and I log on access to the wiki. But I certainly can. Anyway, the documents here, I've tried to, the first page here is the specification as of about last week, from which I have generated a couple of examples. The major changes from the previous one have been the sort of tidying up of the difference between element and ensemble, and I think there's still further work to be done on that to you know, make the concepts a lot simpler. I haven't gone all the way through that. Really, have only sort of tidied that up with respect to the definition of ensemble and how those ensembles are nested. But I think the distinction between element and ensemble can be further tidied up in other areas. I've made some changes to the way things were ordered. They were linked. So, for instance, the parameter maps has moved from ensemble field down to ensemble field function, where it sits more tidily, I think, because if you have a mesh with a set of basis functions defined over that, that may be used by multiple fields. You know, if you have bicubic Hermite mesh and you've got it set up for coordinates as well as you know, temperature, etc., then you want to be able to reuse those. So the ensemble field parameters maps is been tied to the ensemble field function. I've also removed the name requirements for the field parameters and the maps. And you can see partly why. In the last three pages, I have produced a serialized form of the I think the second example that I've got there, the two component field defined over two bicubic Hermite meshes. Right. And in the first one, every parameter, field parameter, and every map had to be named, and it just got way too verbose and not at all clear. So I, as I say, I removed the requirement for naming that. And at the moment, we are simply addressing them by an index. Now, I know that there are objections to that, and I hope to get on to addressing those objections by the grouping and sort of flexible naming system. But at the moment, it's
it's just the raw indices that are carried through. So there's one called the Verbo two-element 2D Hermes 3, where the names are included, and then the second one, which is considerably shorter, where that has been removed. Okay. So the naming has been removed on the ensemble field parameters. It's also been removed on the element field basis functions and the field parameter map, field parameters map. So in all three cases, there you can get a very compact and I guess reasonably decipherable representation. The two examples that I've produced are the just a couple of bicubic Hermes elements or meshes. again, the standard, two component field. I put a note on the top there where ensemble fields is which is the mechanism for aggregating fields. Stuck a note there, a mapping function will be inserted here to enable mapping from ensemble field parameters to each of the ensemble fields parameters to each of the ensemble field parameters. So this is an attempt to address the issue of being able to flexibly organize your field parameters in arbitrary ways. So for instance, the example that we often come back to is being able to organize field parameters in their X, Y, and Z coordinates at a particular node rather than being forced to separate out the components as parameter sets for different fields. So that's my sort of priority, I guess, to work on that. And I suspect, in fact, that the solution to this problem here is going to tidy up mappings in other areas, because essentially we'll just have an object called a parameter map, and that can be then applied to field parameters or aggregations. What else is there? Oh, the second example there, or perhaps the first in the list that I've given a diagram of, is the three bicubic Hermes elements with hanging nodes. And I've included that simply to illustrate the use of general linear maps for the hanging node information. So in this case here, we have seven places where value and derivative information is carried, and then the darked out node in the center there, of course, is a hanging node, so its values, the value and derivative parameter values are picked up from nodes 2 and 6. I don't guarantee that those parameters are sort of correct, but I just chose an averaging as an example.
It's worth pointing out that you change from having that kind of different sorts of maps to
changing
away the different sorts of values in the map.
Right. Yep. So what Shane's referring to there is in the previous sort of iteration of the specs, under ensemble map concept. There was a thing called ensemble field parameters maps, and that had a specialization, ensemble field parameters linear maps.
Boolean maps.
Yep. So it had three separate types of essentially linear maps where in the general case, you could have an arbitrary number of parameters and weights in the sort of real map case, it would have a single parameter and weight associated, corresponding to the way, you know, we sort of generally use the scaling parameters, scaling factors, and then a Boolean map, which was assuming a scaling or a what do you call it, parameter of one, a weighting of one. But that's now been sort of folded up into the each of the maps. So we can have a list of linear maps, right? And each of those can take on different types. And again, that's illustrated in this this example, the hanging node example, where you see name map 2, right? The first, if you look at the first three parameters there, they correspond to a Boolean map. They only have the parameters that they map 1 to 1 to, right? Same with the second, that corresponds to node 3. So parameters 9, 10, 11, and 12 are unity maps. And then the hanging node one, you'll see is each of the parameters is simply an average of the values in nodes 2 and 6. Now, as I say, that's probably wrong, but it's just there to as an illustration. I didn't want to go through the bloody map.
Don't have to implement the basis
function. Yeah, that's right. We actually have to calculate the
position based on the derivative.
So
the basis function.
The yeah, that's right.
Which isn't necessarily linear.
But it is linear. It certainly is. Yes. But in general, you know, in that case, rather than having the average of two parameters, it's actually going to involve a linear combination of 8 parameters, 4 each of the 9.
So in map 1, in fact, you've got weights of 2 and 4. Is that because the size of the element is twice as large?
Yes. So that's like a straightforward scaling factor. They map directly to the scaling factor concept.
They're not familiar with that.
So the reason for having the scaling factors is to give information about the local density of element coordinates across element boundaries.
Yeah.
In doing so, any field that we define over those, which makes use of the same local density change, is going to ensure that we have C1 continuity of the field across the boundary. If we have some fields that have different scaling factors to other fields, then what is going to be smooth for one field is going to be kinked for another.
If you had a small deformation,
you don't. It's a topological issue. It's not a geometric issue.
But we are updating scaling factors in geometry.
You can do that, but yes, in that case, you would have to, as you do now, reassign the values.
Like topologically, there's no apparent difference.
How do you mean?
If you draw it in topological space, though, you've put your discretizing
topologically, you've got no.
Yes, you do. You have element coordinate distances.
Yeah, in xi space.
Yeah.
So xi only goes 0 to a half.
No, it goes 0 to 1 in both of them, but at a different rate.
That's the scaling factor.
Yes,
yeah.
That is the scaling
you
factor.
Say that the rate at which 0 to 1 is varying is different across the two things.
Yeah.
You say that, because your derivatives are continuous, but your scale factor kind of.
So you could assign, you know, arbitrary sort of geometric coordinate field, and still have, you know, continuity of field value across.
Okay, why would you want to do this?
in order to ensure that you have continuous field across element boundaries for all fields that are defined on that mesh.
But why would you want to change the rate at which psi varies?
Well, I mean, Paul argues that that's what scale factors are always doing. It's what scale factors do.
But they only have meaning in the context of the geometry.
No, I don't agree with that. They have meaning. They have a local meaning because they are mapping derivatives.
Right.
They are mapping from something which you consider to be continuous across a boundary at a point. To the derivatives with respect.
Yeah, you can say they apply directly to the xi derivative without any values applied.
But don't we only use them to ensure continuity in real coordinates, not in element coordinates? They're a mapping from element space to real space. Is that?
Well, whatever you need, to have the same. Scaling factors for all fields at that point, defined over that point.
Certainly don't in practice.
Well, then you don't achieve continuity of that field.
Just explain to me real quickly the numbers again for simple the linear amount of one. Didn't speak to the Could you just explain real quick the numbers and the
map? Oh, okay.
So the first row, the
one. So basically, it's mapping from your ensemble field parameters, right? Which
uh-huh.
is
some global list.
Yep, some global
so
list, right?
Two different ones, right?
Well, there. Each of these is for a. Yeah, that's right. There are two different ones.
X and Y.
Yep. So it applies to both of these.
Okay.
So the and that's mapping down to the parameters associated with the first element in this case. So that's another thing that
okay.
I have to address, you know, the proper grouping, because
yeah.
there's an implied ordering here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so for element one...
So map one's element one now.
Yep, that's right. So the first element field parameter in element one maps to the first... ensemble field parameter in both the Y1 field and the Y2 field. Okay. That second parameter there says that that's the, if you think of that as a derivative parameter with respect to the X1 direction, then that is a tuple, so that implies that it is a real map, that is it has a parameter index of 2, which means that it takes the second ensemble field parameter and scales it by a factor of 2, just as we do for scaling factors, right? Similarly, for the third one, which is the derivative in with respect to the x2 direction, and then the fourth one is a cross derivative, so you take the in this case here, the product of those two scaling factors, given that this is, you know, essentially a 2x2 mesh, if you want to have the element coordinates sort of linearly or regularly distributed across the element.
Is this kind of described by the verbose description? More details.
Not the verbose one. No, that's the same information. Oh, there. Yeah, no, there probably is a little bit more information there because I
at
have tried to name them.
At least it's using by name.
Yeah.
At least it's using by name, so you can see that instead of those indices, but there's no weights in there or anything. I don't know why this one doesn't have any weights.
Yeah. Sorry, this one
doesn't have any weights.
May not have been completed because I got so frustrated. And I thought the length of it was enough to justify dropping
it. Which is why I've been trying to get you to write
Example. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm confused here now, because this is only a linear map for one element and not more than one element.
That's right. Or a, yes, in this case here, it's a...
but that's not good, right? We need to actually have one for every element.
Well, that's what we've got that. We've got a
oh, this is the next one here. Yeah, okay, sorry, yeah.
Field,
neuron
final field parameter.
So do you see what we're filling in? We've got 16 numbers to match our 16 basis function parameters.
Okay, that's right.
And those 16 numbers are linear combinations of the large number, in this case here, I don't know, what is it, 24 parameters that we've got describing each of those field components.
And so the first index is roughly equivalent to specifying a node.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay?
That's right.
And the second index is saying a different parameter at that node, i.e. the d by ds1, the first derivative, the second derivative, the third derivative. If we come up with a nice naming scheme, we should be able to use those descriptive names in these templates, as far as I'm concerned. And that's what I did before. I also, like what Greg's been talking about, said, as far as I was concerned, the scaling factors were another bunch of parameters. I just made a list of them and said I'll just use them. But Paul objects to that and says it's a fundamental topology thing.
Mm. So you've already done this for a linear and
that's what
previous.
Sure. Yeah. They're very, very simple examples. Yeah.
So that would basically be just numbers without that.
Yes.
That's
yep.
right.
Yep.
So all this is doing is setting up your mesh without any actual values for the nodal coordinates or the
until those numbers are dumped in at the last minute.
And these ensemble field parameters, those aren't
They are the real space nodals. Yes, those are the nodal real
space nodals. So you've seen here in the Y1 field parameters that it's Y1 or X coordinate, Y1 coordinate, the value is 0 at the first node and 2 at the second node. You can see that's the fourth number there.
Yeah, I brought that up. Although it confused me a while because I think you're missing a node in the hanging node one.
Where?
You've got the same number of parameters you've got without the hanging node in there.
Oh, bugger. Yeah, sorry. No, that does need updating.
But what, say I've got 1,000 by 1,000mesh, it's perfectly regular.
I know.
The size of every element is exactly the same, in this sense, so there's no scale factors associated with anything.
Yep.
You just have a regular map over a million elements. Do I need a million linear map of 16 numbers in order to define that mesh?
Yeah, in this scheme you would. Yeah, just as you require, that for,
This is where I thought templating would resolve some of that you didn't have to.
That's right. I mean, sure, there is scope for templating, making use of an offset, for instance, to.
As far as I'm concerned, it's required.
Yeah.
And I don't see how we come up with it.
So you don't do instruction mesh.
Well, no. If the templates are similar enough that they just have different offsets, different node numbers, then you should be able to reuse most of the stuff.
For example, you add 4 to the numbers and
that's right. You get the next one exactly.
Yeah, it's
totally what you should be able to do. And also, the scaling factors need to be abstracted out of that. If you're just changing the node numbers and the scaling factors, they won't be in general. There'll be arc-length scale factors are different for every element.
That's geometric. That's not a topological feature. That's only
but if there are arc-length scale factors, they still go there as according to the scheme. I can't see there's nowhere else to put them.
But they don't have any meaning until you have values in the ensemble. There's
no reason why you can't update scaling factors, according to geometric information.
Which you need to do.
You don't need to do. That doesn't actually, that's just a convention that CMIS uses. It doesn't need to be done at all.
You need to at the moment. You need to do at the moment.
You don't need to. You can specify them and hold them constant. It doesn't make any difference.
Okay.
It's just something that CMIS does. It doesn't
people do when using CMIS, actually.
But it certainly doesn't. It certainly doesn't.
Carl and I don't tend to use them.
No, I mean, it certainly doesn't preclude, you know, providing those updated values. You just need to stick them in the mesh.
Okay, but the argument also is we need a succinct way of representing both node indices as changing and lists of. Without having to make a new map every time.
Yep, I agree.
Now, did you resolve anything about in the slightly, not the fully voiced one, but the abbreviated version, being able to specify your ensemble field parameters by node rather than by field parameter?
So Paul tried to say that the statement at the top addresses that.
Well,
it's a statement of intent.
Yeah, it will help if we can provide mapping. You know, it's from sets of parameters to other sets of parameters. So, as I said before, you know, that would allow you, for instance, to have a set of parameters associated with an aggregate of fields, like in the coordinates, for instance, to be organized in an arbitrary order and then untangled into the separate components via a mapping specification.
The way I did this before is that I just node was a type of group, and you just said node, component, value. And I used templates so you could just list values and match that against a template of names. And then when you went to use them, you could specify them in the other order. I had tricky stuff to make sure you knew which order, but as it's pointed out, he comes up with a unique value, you don't actually need to worry too much.
So what's described here is actually the internal representation.
The internal representation can't even be like that, because I don't think we can afford to do that either. We can't afford to expand these linear maps out internally either.
Okay, so why do we define it that way?
Because Paul's right.
It's a bit more elegant to decide. But if it's
not... I think as these things evolve, you will see this document continue to change. It's just... when we've got to start at these small little examples, and then when we do write a five-element example, I think, again, it will become too verbose and we'll have five pages and we'll have come up with a shorter notation.
Well, also, you know, it is, like Shane said, an evolutionary thing. You know, a few problems have been solved at a time, and I just want to make sure that the solution that comes up is going to be elegant, that it is going to be practical as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And, you know, it's already happened with the specification changing over the past month or so. It's actually got shorter because we've been able to identify, portions that are able to be reused. And I hope that will happen again with the mapping specification, and yet become more useful, more powerful.
So the end result, should it be the same as the implementation?
I hope that the implementation the implementation and storage though, I expect it to fall within the parameters of this list. You know, like this list will be a general framework and within which you can define
describe the tree of information. But if your implementation has a completely different configuration of that,
then it makes it harder to do the mapping, that's right.
Well, that's where I question why is that, shouldn't this tie closely to the implementation, or is that?
Well, what implementation are you talking about? Because there are many implementations that we would hope that this will be used.
Mm.
And I think it is a mistake to tie it to the existing CMIS implementation.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Well, so what implementation are you talking about then?
The one that we're going to write.
Though. Yeah. For example, the way in which values are stored and the, you know, the even the way that arrays are constructed to store those values, having long list of one field parameter may or may not be an efficient way of doing that in order to split that up over, you know, processes, whatever. Because we're splitting it up not by element field parameter, but by nodal group.
Sure, yeah.
And so this concept isn't going to be close to the implementation of...
Well, I have no idea how you would want to have you know, these concepts organized if you wanted to you know, distribute them all over the place. I think that is, you know, there's a big difference between trying to come up with a sort of a conceptual framework that makes sense, and then an implementation of that where you have to deal with you know, the details of you know, distribution, for instance, that really have nothing to do with the concepts that underlie it. You know, I think that is something that will dictate how the actual implementation will differ from a conceptual view of what is being represented. And I would argue that, you know, at this stage, certainly I'm only concerned with the conceptual view. But I don't think I should be anything else.
Depends whether you want it done this year or next year, though. I mean, if we're ever going to implement it, we have to think about those other things.
Well, you tell me then.
No.
Tell me how else we can accommodate distribution apart from, you know, providing a flexible mapping.
No. I've been actually happy with that concept. That's why it's there.
Yeah.
Because I've been pushing for this thing. I think that's great.
I don't think you can ignore the implementation.
I don't know what the implementation is going to be.
I personally think we should work on distribution for this. I mean, it's complicated things way too much at this point. I mean, I don't think we should be trying to write initially a distributed deep field ML package. I think that's just, I think it's hard enough to try and do simple reaction diffusion and start thinking about distributed field ML.
Anyway, you know, the idea of having as little structure in the you know, set of numbers that can define a field you know, as possible opens it up for a you know, an intelligent package to do the distribution in a very, very simple
way.
I mean, that's basically what ML software is available to do.
That one, but yeah, no, but I agree.
It is. I mean, they do. The whole point of you know, sort of partitioning.
Yeah. You know, no, I'm happy with the progress we're making. But I hold all those things that you've been talking about very highly. And if you looked at the implementation I did last time, I tried to address the halfway house between these two things. Exactly.
How far away are we from implementing this? We were talking at one point, we're just trying to use TMGUI as the, trying to take TMGUI and basically extend what Andrew's done. You briefly mentioned that.
Sure.
And the idea is that we start from scratch on the field of ML, or start with TMGUI, try to adapt it to these new ideas.
No, I was hoping, okay, the migration that I imagined was that if we built something on top of TMGUI, then it would just work there, and we would separately implement this, and then I would port CMGUI to use this, and then the same process could be used to port whatever we've already written as OpenCMIS that might use CMGUI to using this as well. But I think that would be different. However, I expect to be able to access the similar concepts in some way, and therefore, you know, we should be able to port both things. But, I mean, there's nothing extra there because that procedure I have to do with CMGUI anyway. If I've worked out how to do CMGUI to this, then And yeah, I mean, big questions there. Sam Gui intrinsically treats nose as a very special object. How do you deal with it? Okay, I think I'm supposed to be chairing an IT meeting. Thank you very much.